You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When was the last time you saw someone driving, holding a cup of coffee, and talking on a cell phone? Or someone supposedly on vacation but at a computer answering email from the boss? Perhaps you know someone who seems to work all hours while raising a family and maintaining a full social life. Any of those people could be you. Neuroscientist, musician, and McGill University professor Daniel Levitin looks at what it takes to juggle all the things in our lives in his book, The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. It's published by Dutton, and I'm very pleased that it brings Daniel Levitin back to our show today. Hello.
It's great to be back, Leonard.
How rapidly is the volume and complexity of information in our normal lives increasing?
Well, if you want to be mathematical about it, it's exponential. And by that I mean things are coming at us faster than ever before, more information than ever before.
But weren't we talking about information overload in the 60s?
Yes, we were. And, you know, if you go back far enough, the Greeks talked about information overload. As soon as they started writing things down, there was this outcry, we're gonna make stupider people because they won't have to remember things, it'll be written down. When Gutenberg came out with the press, people said, oh, it's the end of civilization and intellectualism as we know it, because there'll be this proliferation of books. Nobody will have time to read them all. What will we do?
And that's turned out to be true, actually.
Yes, it has.
If you look at my library, there are a number of really good books that I'm still planning to read. Are there some places where the problem is greatest, like home, work, or in public spaces?
Well, I think it depends on what you do for a living and a number of factors. But I think one of the problems is all of us, most of us, feel as though when we're at work, we've got nagging things that we had needed to do at home. When we're at home, we're thinking about things at work. And we end up being in neither place, really.
Is that we're being overloaded or over-enticed by more advertising, more options, more escapes?
It's a great question, Leonard. So, you know, there's a lot more distractions, the proverbial shiny objects that babies attend to. We've got Twitter and Vine and Instagram and Facebook and text messages.
And then there's a flood of sensory input that's not information. Noisy streets, aromas piped into stores, amplified music. How great a problem is sensory noise of all the various kinds?
Yeah, that's a great question. I went to a town in Europe that had cobblestone streets, and they didn't allow traffic there, a small village in Belgium in the kingship of Blois. And I was thinking, prior to going there, it's going to be so restful to just be, you know, have no cars, no traffic, no honking. And it was the noisiest place I've ever been outside of Seoul, Korea, because of the horses clip-clopping and the wagons. And so I don't know that noise is a new problem, but surely there is a lot more of a sensory barrage than ever before.
Economists might say that there is a market for more information. If people want more, what's the problem?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. There's a lot of research now that shows that more information in many cases interferes with making good decisions. I'll give you an example. Suppose that you decide you want to buy a new car, and you've decided that you really only care about one feature, and that is safety. Now, there are a number of attributes of safety, the front impact tests and the side impact and the quality of the airbag and all these other things. If you were to start doing your research and you set that priority aside, there'd be all this information about the sound system and is it an 18-inch wheelbase or a 19-inch wheelbase and does it have overhead cams? And if you were tracking all of this, you'd be distracted from the thing you really care about, and it could lead you to make a decision that isn't in your best interest.
Are companies using findings in the brain sciences to try to lure us to watch more television, to follow more social media, to go to more stores?
You know, I haven't heard of very much brain science that's trickled into marketing.
Because it used to be. We had psychologists getting involved in advertising departments and advertisers using what they learned. And there was that fear of the hidden persuaders at one point. We're no longer talking about that sort of thing.
I think there's been a shift. And again, it plays into this idea of information overload that you bring up. when psychologists and neuroscientists are active in advertising, it's to collect information from consumers. They do focus groups, they do experiments, and they collect enormous amounts of data. Look at the data Google has. Everything you've clicked and everything you've bought or looked at but didn't buy is fodder for this big data mining engine.
And then I wonder how that's going to apply to me, other than some ads appearing on the side when I do a search, or if I go to Amazon and they suggest all sorts of books they think I might be interested in. It's easily ignored.
These are early days, right? So the technology isn't quite perfected. But at some point, it may be that when you go to Amazon, the recommendations are exactly what you want, not things that you need to ignore. And that's going to be a great boon to your own efficiency. You'll regain a bunch of time. You'll spend less time filtering through results you don't need. Look at the difference in the Google search engine now from when it first started. I'm willing to bet that you get a lot more desirable hits, the things you wanted at the top of the list, than you used to.
I read recently that restaurant stays tend to be longer because people check out their cell phones for messages before they begin to read the menu. So it's having some kind of odd impact at times. Do you see that as just the way things are? Or because we also talk a lot about split brain ability.
Yeah.
And you'd think that we could do the two things at the same time, look at the menu and also look at our phones. A listener writes in to say, I often catch myself multi-screening where I fiddle with my phone while I watch TV. It's impossible to keep anything straight, but I can't stop doing it.
The reason we can't stop doing it has to do with the way the brain evolved. The brain evolved to be on the alert for the kinds of things that could cause us trouble back in our hunter-gatherer days. Predators, landslides, a potential foe or a potential friend in the environment. But it turns out, Leonard, that multitasking is a myth. It's an illusion. And as a neuroscientist, I could tell you the brain is very good at self-delusion.
But let's take my job here. At the same time as we are having this conversation, I'm listening to you. I'm also looking at the clock. I'm also thinking about what my next question might be and whether if I ask this question, whether it's going to take too long and I'm going to have to go to a break. I'm thinking about the sound quality that's coming into my headphones. I'm doing all those things at the same time. Isn't that split brain? Isn't that multitasking?
You probably are multitasking, and you're doing a lot of things at once. You think you're multitasking. What's actually happening in the brain is sequential tasking. You're going from one to the other very, very rapidly. And I can think of four jobs that require that kind of going rapidly from one thing to another. One is a broadcast journalist. Another is a simultaneous translator at the UN.
I'm amazed at how quickly they can do the translation and still hear what's coming.
Yeah. Another that comes to mind is a publicist or a social media person. And a fourth that comes to mind is air traffic controller. Now, with the UN translator and the air traffic controllers, they have mandated breaks. I don't know that you do, but if you had to do what you did 40 hours a week with no break, I don't think you'd be as effective as you are.
Is there evidence that we're making more mistakes as a result of the overload?
There is, and there's evidence that when you spend the day multitasking without breaks, your productivity is dramatically reduced. A number of experiments show that people who are allowed to unitask versus multitask, at the end of the day, the multitaskers think they did more, but the unitaskers actually did more, and they did better work.
Getting back to that listener's comment about fiddling with his phone while he watches television, I think people do that partly because they get bored. And if you're going through a boring bit on the TV, then you pick up the phone. It means that we actually are perhaps addicted to more stimulation than we were in the past.
We are. In fact, a study came out in April. I don't know if you reported on it. It showed that most people would rather receive a mild electric shock than be left alone with their thoughts for just a few minutes.
Oh, wow.
We've reached a point where we want the constant stimulation, and you
know
why?
That sounds scary.
It's because of what I call a dopamine addiction loop. Every time you get some new shiny stimulus, your brain gives you a little squirt of dopamine, which makes you feel good, and you keep wanting that shot of dopamine, and it's to the detriment of being able to do quality work in many cases.
Well, are we getting used to all of the stimulus? Is it becoming habitual?
I think we're raising the threshold for what we think we need to stay engaged.
You're right. Our genes haven't fully caught up with the demands of modern civilization. Have they caught up at all? Is there any evidence that basic human biology is changing in response to the evolution of technology and civilization?
It's too early to tell. These kinds of changes take thousands of years, not usually. We refer to it as evolutionary lag. It takes a while for the genome to catch up to what we're living through.
You talked about needing to take breaks. Is that why some people just become couch potatoes and sit there and mindlessly watch television?
That's not a break. What I'm talking about is alternating between periods of focused and exacting work and then breaks, like the air traffic controllers do, or like you do in your job. Maybe you work for an hour or two, you take half an hour off, you work again. That's the key to being productive and efficient. And the key to being...
They don't let me take those times off.
They don't?
No.
Well, we should talk to your boss about that. I got a pile of research studies for your boss.
Should we build in breaks?
We should, if we want to be most effective and productive. A nap is very helpful. If you're the kind of person who can take naps and you're in an environment where they're possible, even a short 10-minute nap can have the equivalent of an extra hour and a half sleep at night.
You describe looking at a friend's junk drawer, the drawer where things are dumped when there's no place to put them. What is the significance of that?
I don't know about you, but I'm fascinated by junk drawers. Everybody has one, right? And I think what they
We have to know where we put those cufflinks and the passport.
Right. So to me, the junk drawer represents a success in that you're following the advice and the pattern of highly successful, efficient people. You got something in your hand. There's probably a perfect place in the house for it. But a dictum of the successful people is don't spend more time on a decision than it's worth. So as soon as you're throwing in the junk drawer, you're saying, this is good enough. I'm moving on. I'm not going to waste time on this.
Do we use our computers as digital junk drawers?
We do, and sometimes that's good. If you can find a file by searching for the contents or the name, you don't have to worry about what folder you put it into. But that impedes the kind of browsing that often results in, serendipity and nonlinear findings.
Hasn't there been some controversy over how much tools like fMRI are in fact revealing about how our brains work and whether there's split brain activity or not?
You're right. fMRI has been controversial. Since the last time you and I talked, I think neuroscientists have come to an understanding that
last time we talked was about music.
Yeah. We talked about music in the brain and the neuroscience. And in the last few years, we've come to an increased recognition that cognitive operations are probably not all localized to specific parts of the brain, but they're distributed as networks, much like electrical circuits throughout your house or your office. And so fMRI has helped us to see that, but not all of it. And so in my lab, for example, we've been looking in the last few years at neurochemistry as a way to better understand what's happening.
Getting back to the whole business of searching on a computer, is there something to be said for the old ways of searching, like going to a card catalog at the library as opposed to a digital search?
Well, we were talking about serendipity a minute ago, and I think that card catalogs and libraries are great for discovery and for creativity. When I wrote this book, it's no accident that I wrote a lot of it in public libraries and university libraries, because I would go to the shelf looking for something, and of course along the way something would catch my eye, and it would be not what I thought I wanted, but something that was lovely.
But the card catalogs are all gone.
Not all. There's still some libraries that have them, and of course the digital card catalogs sometimes function in the same way if they show you related titles.
My guest is Daniel J. Levitin, who is the James McGill Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Neuroscience at McGill University and Dean of the College of Arts and Humanities at the Minerva Schools at KGI. His latest book, The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload, is published by Dutton. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Daniel J. Levitin, who is the author of the New York Times best-selling book, This Is Your Brain on Music. It brought him here the last time he was on our show. Now he's here to talk about The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. It's published by Dutton. Last week, you had an essay in the New York Times about taking a real break from work. What's the difference between a real break and, what, a false one?
Yeah, well, most of us, many of us anyway, when we go on vacation, we're tethered to email and to the office, and you know, we're not really on vacation then. And the brain is a living organism of its own in a way. And I mean, it's got a metabolism, it's got living cells, it needs a break. And particularly if we can get out to nature, anything in a natural environment, or engage with art during these breaks, and stay away from work, it can be very restorative. And our most creative work and ideas can come to us during these times.
Although a little bit of connection back at the home office seems to me to not be awful, especially if you're going to have to come back to all sorts of problems that you might be able to resolve just with a quick email.
One thing that I've done on vacations is set aside an hour for email a day, but partitioned it and guarded it jealously. And so I don't get back to the office with 600 emails piled up. And I do it at the end of the day so that I can enjoy the morning wherever I am.
In the essay in the Times and at greater length in your book, you describe two modes of attention in the brain, the task positive and task negative. Can you explain them and how they relate to this problem of information overload?
These are the names that neuroscientists use, but the task positive network is very simple. It's when you're engaged in a task and you're not distracted and you're performing well. So you might be reading, you might be writing a report, doing research. You might be a tile setter or a wood floor layer, and you're really engaged with the task. This alternates in the brain with the task negative or daydreaming mode. Have you ever been reading a book and you suddenly realized your eyes had gotten ahead of you and you hadn't been paying attention for a while and you have to go back?
Of course.
That's the daydreaming mode kicking in. It's what we call the default mode of the brain. It's exerting a pull on consciousness all the time.
But is that bad? Isn't a certain amount of daydreaming healthy?
It's the opposite of bad. It's healthy and good. The problem is...
Oh, good, because I do that all the time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the problem is in this over-caffeinated world, we feel as though we've got to keep going every minute, and we don't allow that system to kick in.
So how does the brain balance the two modes?
Well, it does it very naturally. If you just allow yourself some time, maybe after every couple hours of work, 15 minutes to stare out the window. Now, break isn't watching YouTube videos or texting. A break is going for a walk outside if you can, looking at a piece of art, listening to music, doing something different. And that actually increases productivity. You look at people at the end of the day, and if they took breaks, they got more done.
Americans take and get less vacation time than workers in any other industrialized country, and one quarter of American workers get no paid vacation at all. Do you see a problem in that lack of downtime or rest?
It leads to lowered productivity.
But we have the highest productivity in the world.
Could be higher, perhaps. Here's a statistic. If you work 60 hours a week instead of the normal 40, you might think that you're getting a lot more done. But according to several studies, that extra 20 hours you work between 40 and 60 only yields 7 hours of productive work.
Well, then that would suggest that 35 hours or 25 hours would be even better. And haven't we heard over the years that with new technologies that was going to happen? There were predictions of 25-hour work weeks, and It's never happened. In fact, if anything, our work weeks are getting longer.
So I don't think it implies that less time than 40. There aren't any studies that show that 25 hours is just as productive as 40. 40 is a good number. My point is that you don't want to have to spend 3 hours overtime for every 1 hour of productivity.
How is organization related to our ability to focus or to be disciplined or prioritize?
Well, being organized and being conscientious are factors that contribute to longevity, a number of health outcomes, life satisfaction. And the way they do that is that, well, for one thing, if you're organized, you don't miss doctor's appointments. In all of this, Leonard, when I'm talking about being organized, I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not talking about us becoming robots, scheduled every minute of the day, Mr. Spock logical people.
Everything in its place always.
What I'm talking about is...
You haven't seen my
desk. What I'm talking about is if you can be organized during your workday and be efficient, at the end of the day, you've got more time to be spontaneous, to spend time with family, to be creative, to enjoy leisure activities, because you're not worried about all you didn't do at work.
You mentioned satisficing. What is satisficing?
I love this word. This was coined by the Nobel Prize-winning psychologist and economist Herbert Simon from Princeton. And satisficing to Simon is being satisfied with something when it's good enough and it doesn't need to be perfect. So as an example, if you live in Manhattan, there might be 20 bodegas to choose from, 20 dry cleaners. Are you going to try every single one of them to find out who does the best job with your shirts or which bodega has the best tuna salad? Probably it's not worth the time. When you find one that's good enough, that's satisficing, and you don't waste time trying to come up with an incremental improvement that may not actually make you happier. You know, Warren Buffett is a great example of this. He's lived in the same relatively modest house for 50 years now in Omaha, near the freeway, one of the richest men in the world, and he just decided it's good enough.
We invite our listeners to join the conversation by writing us at you can tweet us at Leonard Lopate or give us a call at 212-433-9692. My guest is Daniel J. Levitin. His latest book, The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload, published by Dutton. You were here in 2006 to discuss This Is Your Brain on Music. Do you see a connection between how we process music and how we manage the deluge of data and activity in our lives?
Well, you and I have been talking about the importance of taking breaks, real breaks, letting your mind wander. And for many people, music can induce that brain state. It's not the only thing, looking at a piece of art, looking at a sunset, making love. But the idea that there's some music that can help us feel dreamy and put us in that dream mode, relax us, relax the neural circuits that are all stressed out from work. I think all of us know that there's some music that does that.
Well, there are some musical traditions like Indian music that actually try to induce something like a trance state.
And we've got electronic music now, trance music.
But there's a scene in Amadeus where Mozart says, and I'm quoting, "In a play, if more than one person speaks at the same time, it's just noise. But with music, you can have 20 individuals all talking at once, and it's not noise. It's perfect harmony."
That's one of the most amazing things, isn't it? It's lovely. You can't pay attention to more than two people talking at once under most circumstances. But you go and hear an orchestra, 80, 90 different musicians, and, you know, playing dozens of different parts, and they all cohere into one whole. It's a marvel.
Although you can say, I'm going to focus on the horns right now.
Yeah. Using the power of your attentional system, that great attentional system that evolution gave us, you can say, I'm going to listen to just the French horn, and, oh, now I want to listen to the string bass.
Data scientist Alex Pentland was a guest on the show last February, and he argues...
Sandy. Sandy Pentland, yeah.
That's what you called him. I called him sir. He argues that in many workplaces, you see too few interactions among employees. Aren't there times when more is better?
You know, I just visited Stanley McChrystal's consulting firm last week in Alexandria, Virginia, General McChrystal. Mm-hmm. And they did this ritual every day where everybody in the company stands up for 15 minutes and they talk about what they're all working on. And I thought that was a marvelous model for productive and efficient communication and workflow. If somebody says, oh, I'm having a little bit of trouble, I need some help. Somebody else says, well, I got a few extra cycles today. So I think modern offices are evolving to give people a little of both, some quiet downtime with their email off and some communicative time where they share information.
It used to be around the water cooler.
Yeah.
But bosses would get upset when they saw you hanging around the water cooler. Should they have been pleased?
I think it depends. If you're talking about what was on television last week, that's different than if you're talking about work. And, you know, there has to be a balance, like anything else.
Is there any weight to the idea that people with messy desks or surroundings are more creative?
I don't know that they're more creative, but I wouldn't say that a clean desk is necessary to be creative and efficient. a lot of people are pilers and some are filers, right? There are probably equal numbers of both. And the pilers have these sort of geological time spans of documents, and they know how far down in the stack they need to look to find something. I do both. At home, I'm a filer. And at work, I'm a piler.
A listener on Twitter asks, should people reduce their amount of texting and emailing versus talking to better manage their time?
I think it comes down to a question of priorities. So if you're texting and Facebooking and all this stuff all day long, it becomes a distraction from being able to sustain concentration on your work or your leisure or your hobbies. You want to be able to engross yourself in activities to get the most from them. And so the experts recommend partitioning your day. Set aside an hour when you do email, or, you know, limit checking email to 3 times a day. Do all your social networking at a prescribed time.
In the past, we would pick up the phone, but today we have these other options. And sometimes you might think, well, if I call my friend, that's going to be 10, 15 minutes because we're going to talk about all sorts of other things. If I just tweet or text, it'll be very specific.
You know, what a lot
so
of...
So that could be more efficient.
Yes, you're right. I interviewed a lot of highly successful people for the book, CEOs, rock stars.
You call them HSPs.
Yeah, highly successful people. And what they tend to do is they partition these different modes of communication. So a lot of them open up a separate email account that they give only to their intimates or people they need to hear from right away. They turn off the regular email account when they're working. Maybe they give out their cell phone number to only certain people, or they have 2 cell phones, and they know that if a text comes into one of them, it's somebody they want to hear from, and if it comes in the other, it can wait.
They also often have a lot of money, so they can pass off the mundane tasks to somebody else. I can't imagine that Bill Gates or Michael Bloomberg has done his own laundry in the past 20 years. And that can backfire at times. In the 1992 campaign, George H.W. Bush didn't know the price of a gallon of milk and had never seen a barcode scanner, and people felt he was out of touch.
So that's a hazard of having people as your support network. I'm not saying that we should hire assistants. I'm saying we can learn from what those assistants do for their bosses, and we can incorporate a lot of their tricks into our daily life, and I devote a fair amount of space in the book to that.
When the privileged, the decision makers, and the circle around them are insulated from the daily grind, are there social consequences?
Oh, I think so. And I don't think it's anyone's desire to be insulated from the daily grind, but as you say, it's an artifact and one that takes some effort to overcome.
Let's take a call from Diane from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air. Diane?
I'm Debbie.
Okay, well.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I didn't know I was on. Hello. My name is Debbie. I'm an occupational therapist, and I read a lot about the kind of work that you do, and I love neuroscience books. The reason I do is because I try to incorporate that information while I work with children in the New York City public school system. And what I am wondering is if when I work with a child who comes across as unable to follow through on a task completely start to finish, loses interest. Should I be thinking that that's more neuroscience-based or personality trait or a combination? And if you can differentiate between character trait like procrastinators, is that neurologically based? Thank you.
Thank you, Debbie. Well, it's both. It's neurological and it's trait-based. Both are subserved by genes to some extent, by environment, and by brain development. You can train people not to procrastinate. You can train them and encourage them to focus on tasks for more than just a minute or two. It can take some time, but I would recommend building it up gradually. And, you know, a friend of mine, Jake Ebert, who is a film producer, he had done Driving Miss Daisy and Gandhi and The River Runs Through It, a number of films. Jake used to say, eat the frog, meaning find the most unpleasant task of the day and do it first as a way to avoid procrastinating.
That's because he never had frog's legs. They're pretty good. You devote a chapter to what to teach our children. Is there a critical lesson for kids here?
Well, this relates very intimately to my work as Dean of Arts and Humanities at Minerva, a new undergraduate university program in California, part of the Claremont Consortium. And what we're teaching our undergraduates is critical thinking skills, and we think this should trickle down to high school and elementary school. A lot of schools give lip service to critical thinking, but in an age of information overload, where facts and information change so rapidly, the single most critical thing we can teach children is how to evaluate information so that they can use it more creatively and intelligently to help solve some of the world's biggest problems.
Since people under about 15 or so have grown up with the social media, digital devices, et cetera, shouldn't we be looking for what we can learn from them?
I think there's learning to go in both directions. So they're a lot more technologically savvy than we are. They may be more social network savvy, but our generation has developed techniques for evaluating the quality of information. A lot of kids I run into, even very, very bright ones, don't know about Google Scholar, for example. The idea that you can go to scholar.google.com and get only scientific papers, which filters your results to things that are likely to be more accurate. They don't know, for example, that if you're trying to find out about a health claim, you're probably going to get better information from the Centers for Disease Control or the National Institutes of Health website than, say, the Almond Growers of America, who want you to eat almonds because they say they're better for brain health.
Daniel J. Levitin is the James McGill Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Neuroscience at McGill University, Dean of the College of Arts and Humanities at the Minerva Schools at KGI. And his latest book is The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. It is published by Dutton. Thank you so much for being with us again.
My pleasure, Leonard.